Welcome to a new episode of Erasing Shame, and this is our grand finale episode for season four of our journey around the world. My co-host Helen Choi, and we're joined with Tony Kim, who is a counselor therapist in the East Coast between New York and Virginia and internationally around the world through online means. And we are in such a unique moment that we just want to acknowledge as we're having this conversation, because we are still in the midst of a very stressful time with the pandemic and now the protests, and yet we do want to be aware of our mental health as well. So how are you doing, Helen, and how are you doing, Tony?
I am so excited and happy to see you, DJ, and Tony, doing this podcast on a very important topic on mental health, shame, and trauma, especially within the Korean diaspora from a cross-cultural mental health standpoint. I know that there's a really big need in, especially now more so than ever, cross-cultural mental health issues being put to the spotlight, and especially in the midst of this pandemic with a rising, you know, anti-Asian racism on top of, you know, the anti-Black racism. And there's a big call for culturally competent counselors. And today we have Tony Kim, who is in America, in the East Coast, who, you know, spends her time and also her passion committed and dedicated to helping people to unpack some of their trauma and shame that's associated. So welcome, Tony.
Thank you, guys. Thank you so much for having me. I feel so honored to be part of this conversation. I really can't express enough gratitude for this platform. I think that it is definitely something that the community needs more so than ever. And I know that today we're going to be speaking about the Korean American experience, but I think that when it comes to our collective trauma, we can all relate, and hopefully we can express some compassion for each other.
Well, thank you, Tony, for that. Just for our listeners, could you just give us a high level overview of your background and credentials?
Okay. So I'm a holistic integrative trauma-informed psychotherapist based out of New York City. So I specialize in kind of trauma-informed modalities like EMDR, brain spotting, and mindfulness. I have a master's of social work from NYU, New York University. That's pretty much, I guess, a basic gist of it.
Great. And what made you get into this line of work?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I've always been interested in giving back to the community in some way, but I think what motivated me to go back for my master's in social work was because of my own therapy experience. I had a really great experience with my therapist at that time, which was really healing and eye-opening for me. So I wanted to go back to school and do the same type of work. I wanted to go out there and help people get to a place of personal healing and personal growth.
So on the note of personal healing and personal growth, for our listeners who are not familiar with the concept of shame and trauma, could you just give sort of like an explanation for our audiences?
Yeah, I mean, so I like to define trauma in a very broad way. Like we like to joke that most of us don't survive childhood without some sort of trauma. And I usually define trauma as some emotionally disturbing or distressing experience that has kind of encoded a limiting personal belief. And I found that through therapeutic modalities like EMDR, that you can kind of process this trauma and become unstuck and encode new empowering beliefs.
What does EMDR stand for?
Eye movement desensitization reprocessing.
What's that?
I know, it's a mouthful. It's a mouthful, and you know, it's a somatic based therapeutic modality. So somatic means like body based modality to process trauma, because the way that trauma gets stuck in our experience is through our like nervous system, and in our brains it gets kind of frozen because we don't have the capacity to handle it at the time that it happens. So our body kind of gets stuck in this traumatic state, and it instills a instills a disempowering belief.
Yeah.
And so EMDR uses something called a bilateral stimulation to help process these traumatic experiences and beliefs.
Yeah. So is that, how common is, I mean, I don't want to derail the conversation, but I recently heard about EMDR being used for, let's say, survivors with PTSD.
Yes. Uh-huh. It's, I guess.
Yeah. And I never heard about it until this year. And I wondered how come I never heard about it before. Is it new in treating, you know, let's say, for example, you know, we are Korean Americans, you know, can that be used, let's say, for intergenerational trauma?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really excited that you're hearing about it. It's actually been really well researched for PTSD, for depression, for anxiety. They did a lot of research with PTSD with veterans, and they've shown it to be very effective. And mm-hmm. it's been around actually for over 30 years. I think that it's only becoming more mainstream. It usually takes that long, I think, for things to transition from the research setting to like the public. So it's exciting that you're hearing about it, because it's a really effective therapy for trauma. Mm. And for, I guess, I would define it as like non-traditional trauma. As in like distressing experiences that you might have that might fall outside the scope of what we traditionally think of as trauma.
So, like, I think trauma is such a really big focus right now, especially in social work and the nonprofit or public sector. I think on our first episode, me and DJ, you know, we were kind of joking about trauma-informed care.
Mm-hmm.
DJ was like, what is that?
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes you can come across like jargons or buzzwords, mm-hmm. right? But especially now with, you know, the rise of Black Lives Matter, you know, mm-hmm. protests with, you know, racialized people and their, I hate to say this, but the parading of Black and Indigenous populations and their parading of public trauma, essentially. You know, this topic of healing, of trauma. As a clinical psychologist, and also, I guess, speaking on intergenerational trauma and how you spoke earlier about people being sort of stuck, can you speak more on that, on how the body keeps a score?
Yes, which is a great plug for that book by Bessel van der Kolk, which speaks about how trauma stays in our nervous system, in our bodies. And I think that, I guess, integrating this topic in relation to like the Korean American or Asian community, I know that culturally we do not talk about a lot of the things that that happened to us. Mm-hmm. I think our strategy is to kind of repress some of these experiences. I know that for a lot of Korean American immigrants, our parents were kind of in this survival mode, you know, being in a foreign country, you know, not knowing the language, having to pretty much start over from scratch without any social, financial support. And I imagine having to deal with racism themselves during that time when most of our parents immigrated here, which is probably like the 70s and the 80s. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I recently had a conversation with someone from that generation, and they were speaking about a relative who was expressing feelings of depression, and that elder was confused as to why there was an issue, because for them, they just kept busy, you know, and so his feeling was that this person was not busy enough, and hence she was experiencing these feelings of depression. And so, you know, there was kind of a lack of desire to kind of acknowledge maybe some of this collective trauma that we might have experienced or that has been passed on from our parents through their experience.
Yeah, I really like taking also a historical approach to the narrative mm-hmm. and the stories and, you know, the grief that gets passed down. And really, I guess, you know, you and I, we're both Koreans and Korean women. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, I think there was like a statistic I found very interesting, where something like, according to the National Violence Against Women study, 60% of Korean American women reported physical abuse or to be living in domestically violent households.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And,
I mean, it really saddens me to hear this is a thing in the immigrant experience. And more so with this pandemic, there's also a rise in phone calls to the women's shelters, and not enough space to actually hold space for, you know, immigrant mm-hmm. women and their children. But beyond that, I mean, is, you know, through several studies, results have shown that Korean immigrants who experienced physical assault like children were more likely to tolerate acts of violence from their spouse in adulthood.
Yeah.
Do you think you could speak a bit more to this research?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is just a testament to how culturally we silence some of our cultural trauma. I mean, 60% of Korean women reporting domestic violence and children who witness that violence being more susceptible to either perpetrating that violence or, you know, being a victim of violence in the future indicates that there is some relationship there. And I think that is something to be noted. I think that there has been research that shows that trauma is passed down at least up to three generations genetically, that there is some inheritability to the trauma, that something gets switched on genetically when someone experiences an extremely stressful experience.
Hey, I think I've read an article about that concept, epigenetics.
Yeah, epigenetics.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Wow.
It's almost like subconscious stuff that gets transmitted through our genes and through our socialness as a family systems and all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you don't necessarily inherit the gene per se, but you are more primed for that similar experience.
Yeah, I think the part of the research, and especially the research that you shared with me, to share with, I guess, the listeners, is this cyclical pattern that seems really difficult to break, which is that, you know, due to the harm of the model minority myth, that a lot of times Asian immigrants may be overlooked by social services and are not given the helpful resources to overcome some of the verbal and physical violence within our own community. And that basically due to the traditional belief in, I guess, indoctrinated Confucius, you know, just saving face, right? That disclosing problems for others would be seen as weak and deteriorating the family's name, the honor, and bringing that shame. And it really saddens me how the relationship between shame and trauma really is a stronghold. And for our listeners, would you have any sort of remedies on how we can break the shame and the silence?
Yeah, I mean, I think that platforms like this are amazing. I think part of it is just knowing that you're not alone in your experience. I mean, in the statistics of domestic violence, 68% of other women or families are unfortunately experiencing the same thing that you are. And I think that kind of bringing light to that unfortunate situation, I think, is important. I think that we're hiding behind this concept of saving face, not bringing shame to our family, and at the detriment of healing. And I would love for people to continue to have these conversations. And obviously, I'm biased, but seeking a objective professional to kind of unpack some of these experiences, having a safe space to kind of talk about these things, I think, is a great place to begin. I know that a lot of my Asian American clients, they are learning to put language to their experience for the first time. You know, they've just been holding a lot of these traumas and these experiences without the tool of having the emotional language to describe what they've been through. You know, I think that that is one area that therapy is really helpful at, is like helping you kind of just identify the emotions that go along with your experience. Because I'm not sure about other cultures, but I know that in like Korean culture, there isn't a lot of education on naming your feelings, you know. So I think that it's important to begin just naming what is this feeling, you know, to just begin the healing process.
That is so good, because when I think about, you know, Korean language and naming some deep feelings, what I often hear, and it's kind of ironic too at the same time, to find out statistically under all of the OECD countries, South Korea is listed as top for having the highest suicide rate. And I thought about it, and we often say in Korean, 죽고 싶어. 죽을래? And we say it like it's nothing. And if you don't know what 죽을래 means, it means you want to die. Or 죽고 싶어 means I want to die. Like, I mean, if you watch Korean soap operas and Korean dramas, Korean movies, you often hear that word 죽을래 a lot.
Yeah, and I can attest to how common that is, because my non-Korean friends know how to say that.
Your white friends know how to say 죽을래?
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Talk about having some woke friends. Girl, wow.
But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I remember having a conversation with someone, another Korean-American person, and they talked about this concept of Han in Korean culture. Are you familiar with it?
Yeah.
It's like this kind of, I interpreted it as like this deep burning undercurrent of emotion that, and fire, like some passion or fire that is difficult to express. Like, it's like kind of overbearing and collective at the same time. And this person felt like they can only express this Han, experience of Han, feeling of Han, when he was drinking. And so like, I thought that was interesting, because collectively as a culture, we depend on our drinking culture in a lot of different ways. And so I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I remember studying about Korean anthropology and Korean language at Yonsei University. And in my Korean language and anthropology class, I was taught that it's not unusual mm-hmm. to drink soju with family members or your colleagues or your friends, or especially if you're trying to woo a Korean woman and you want to get on the good side of the parents, to get a little drunk with the parents to feel close and do not reject soju.
Mm-hmm.
That would be considered like shame.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm familiar with that.
Yeah, and I think along with this experience of shame is the experience of vulnerability. I think that it kind of goes like hand in hand. Like this kind of vulnerable openness that we as a culture try to protect ourselves against. And when I study kind of our history, it makes sense. You know, like we've had many attempted colonizations. Even Japan, the Japanese occupation was very recent.
Yeah, less than 100 years ago.
Yeah.
The survivors are still alive. The comfort women.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I when I think about the Korean comfort women, especially the survivors who are still alive today, and I just don't know how they managed to stay so powerful. But I guess that's sort of, you know, like you were mentioning, being able to name our emotions, name our experiences, that really ultimately liberates ourselves from these strongholds.
Mm-hmm.
For in terms of, I guess, like for people who resist the idea of seeking, or I wouldn't say getting help from counseling, because there's a lot of shaming around the idea of, first of all, getting help, talking to a counselor. You know, what would you have to say about that to our listeners?
Like in terms of like, what are some other possibilities for people to achieve healing?
Like what would be the outcome? Yeah. Of getting, I guess, someone who's been professionally trained to listen and to filter out some of the cognitive distortions.
Yeah, I mean, I think I touched on it a little bit before, just having a safe place to examine and explore and name your feelings, your thoughts, your experience. I know that often my Asian American clients come in feeling like they can't do that in their like family settings,
mm-hmm.
and oftentimes even their friend settings, because there's so much cultural shame around that. So I think just offering a space where they can explore those elements of themselves.
Healing is possible, right?
Absolutely.
No, I'm asking this because I was told, as someone who was diagnosed with PTSD, that there's no cure.
Ah.
Have you heard that before?
Gosh. Oh.
So, I mean, there's got to be hope.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't want to disparage that person, but that breaks my heart a little bit that was the message. I absolutely believe and have seen healing in my work with the people who have been open and courageous enough to do the work.
Well, thank you, Tony. This has been very affirming. Is there anything you would like the listeners to know before we wrap up? And how can people be in touch with you, because I know you are part of a circle that also provides affordable access.
Yeah, I want to just encourage everyone to maybe just invite the possibility of seeking out a therapist or a trusted counselor in their area to start exploring some of their own personal experiences. I know that access might be limited for some, so I highly recommend openpathcollective.org. They offer affordable sliding scale therapy. I think it's $30 to $60 per session. They are available, I think, all throughout the U.S. I'm not sure about Canada.
Canada has a completely different health system.
You guys, don't need as much help as, or need as much access as we might need.
But I mean, we still have to. Okay, so what's really interesting about Canada and the U.S. And me and Tony talked about this before the taping of the show, and is especially during this pandemic and with the new, you know, government, it health is a provincial jurisdiction. In the U.S., what's the equivalent of a province? I think it's like state, but we call it province here. Like, yeah, so the Ontario government has allocated some new funds to make sure that mental health is accessible for all under our health coverage. But there's a long lineup, and there are private clinical psychologists who normally charge over $100. So when I hear something like $30 to $60 an hour, that's good. That's really good. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no shame.
Yeah. So well, I forgot the last piece that you were requesting.
I think the last piece was just basically how can people get in touch with you, and beyond, you know, access, like what would you like the listeners to know as concluding remarks for the final episode of season 4?
So people can learn a little bit more about me at my website, tony.idkim.com. And I just want to say thank you to you guys for creating such a beautiful platform for different Asian American voices, Asian voices. Around mental health and mental health stigma and shame. I think this is just such a beautiful thing that's happening here. And I would love for the conversations to continue. If you do not pursue therapy, just sharing maybe your experience with people that you trust and you love, or communities that you love and trust, I think continuing to just speak and honor and create space for yourself, knowing that you deserve to take up space and hold space, I think that's where we're going to have to begin and continue to be, not just for ourselves, but for everyone around us and our communities as well. So thank you so much.
Great. Thank you, Tony. Those are inviting words and healing words. And I hope our viewers and listeners will take take the opportunity to get on that journey of healing for themselves and for the people they love and care about around them. So Tony is a new mom, so congratulations on a healthy daughter.
Yay.
Thank you for making time to chat with us in the midst of a very busy, very full season, I'm sure. Helen, if you've got a minute, I wanted to hear how has this season been for you. Thank you for journeying along with us. I know a lot of different people have gotten to listen in, and you even got to bump into some people that heard about the podcast.
Yes. Well, this journey of healing around the world has been really opening. I got to reflect, like what Tony talked about, learning to name the emotions that previously I didn't know how to express myself. I think it was quite extremes. It was in the extremes, you know, like it was either you just kind of bottle it up, I don't know. It's just, I found it really, what I love the most about this season and the journey of healing is in this age of hyper digital disruption, where we can be instantaneously connected digitally. We can see what's happening in the world instantly, even through viral Facebook videos. I really appreciated, especially with the season, taking a multi-ethnic, cross-cultural perspective and hearing from like the Black communities, for example, especially right now with a lot of the uprising from the Black Lives Matter movement. So I think it was really great that we were able to touch upon and hear, especially taking an intersectional approach and hearing from Black women and their experiences. And not just that, but, you know, I really appreciate you, DJ, in your passion and commitment to continue on in exploring, deconstructing, and unpacking the million and different ways of how shame is so operationalized in our lives.
Thank you.
So thank you. And I hope that people who are supporting the Erasing Shame podcast will see it also as a movement and will contact the Erasing Shame and show how they can support or join or speak up about their experiences and what brings them shame and what ultimately brings liberation and healing.
Amen. Thank you, Helen. And it's been a joy to journey with you as well. And you've added a lot into my life from that Canadian and that spunky perspective. And for anyone watching and listening.
Oh, yeah, we also have to air that Santa Claus is actually Canadian, just here on Erasing Shame.
Okay. We'll dig that up in the show notes. So the show notes will have a link to Tony's website as well as Open Path Collective and some of the articles that we referenced. And as we debrief, we'll add a few more bonuses in there. For you listeners and viewers, you can support us by liking us on Facebook, subscribing on YouTube, and subscribing on your podcast app, whether that's Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever else, and leave a review on iTunes and Apple Podcasts so that others can hear the many conversations and stories that we've had over the years. And we hope to continue into the future. Helen, please know that the welcome mat is open anytime for you to drop in again. I want you to be free to pursue your next season as well, but we will have an open door here for you to check in from time to time as you are available. Because as we share our stories, I think it empowers others to also find the courage to share their stories and to erase shame and find healing in their lives. So with that, we'll wrap up season 4. And we pray that you will have a journey of healing that blesses your life as well in the future.